The Law of Equivalent Exchange. This is Tim in Tokyo reading Full Metal Alchemist in English from Viz.
And this is Patrick in Mifune, the middle of Kumamoto, which is in the middle of Kyushu, reading Hagane no Renkin Jutsushi by Hiromu Arakawa, published by Gangan Comics.
This is chapter 91, A Reunion of Alchemists. Sort of an odd chapter here because they're 12 pages before the splash page.
Yeah, that's kind of a rare thing. We haven't had this much of a cold open before.
Yeah, and in fact, it made me flip back. Like, was this actually part of the previous chapter? Did I miss it? But there's a black page in between, so...
I did the same thing.
Clearly, this is the next chapter.
In fact, there's what... Well, it is just the one scene before they go into the title.
Right, it's one scene, but it's 12 pages. It's a lot more than you usually get before the splash. So this chapter, we start a bit distant from the dome that's been holding Pride and Al, a bit back from it, and we see Yoki and Marco and some other people who are wondering why there are soldiers there. Now, we can assume that these soldiers were accompanying Kimberly, who is near the dome, but these people... I guess, didn't see Kimberly, don't know what's going on. And they don't know that Kimberly just broke Pride out of the dome.
Mm. And Yoki speaks. we haven't heard him speak.
Yeah, he's quite mostly a while. Just been doing humorous facial expressions and stuff. So Marco is concerned that Al is in danger, and Yoki says, we can't let them find out that you're Dr. Marco, because, his scrunched up face is his disguise. And if they know that he's Marco, he'll get arrested, probably.
And used as a hostage.
But Yoki talks him into standing back and not approaching the dome, not trying to help Al. That's the safer option. So they stand back, and we don't see them again this chapter. But we can see that there's smoke coming from the dome, which they don't comment on. And then we jump over to the dome, where we were at the end of the previous chapter, and Kimberly is there with Pride getting out of the dome, and Kimberly's wondering where Gluttony is.
But Pride, look at Pride, what he's doing with poor Al's head.
Yeah, just swinging it around by the feather.
Swinging it around. How rude. And then he just like, poit, and tosses it to him.
He's like, oh, I ate Gluttony.
Yeah, and he said, your nakama, your
ally in the English.
Yeah, your ally. And he says, like, he's not my nakama. We are the one of the same body or something like that.
Yeah, we are one and the same. Both of us were born from the same father. We just went back to being one, that's all. So, yeah. Kimberly's kind of confused.
Now, this is something that I read a little while ago, that there was some discussion, I think, among fan translators about the use of the word nakama and just like keeping it as nakama, even in the English. Because, like what happens is like you get enough fan translators, enough people watching or used to consuming language in another culture, like certain words, especially if you're reading a lot of jump stuff, like Shonen Jump, the word nakama is going to come up a lot,
right?
Because there's a pattern pretty firmly established.
Mm-hmm. Friendship, teamwork.
yeah. So it was just the weirdest conversation to me, just because I hadn't been consuming Japanese comics in either professionally or fan translated, through those means. And so it just kind of reminded me, hit it home, that like when a work exists in another culture, in another language, it's like it's not the same. You know, like there's the culture built around it is not going to be the same kind of culture. Like the fans are not going to be exactly the same, and they won't be consuming it the same necessarily, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting.
It's a far cry from 25 years ago when they were flipping all the pages.
And, yeah.
You know, so that it would be in the Western style of book. I mean, it's been a long time now that since they quit flipping and just, nope, this is a Japanese style book. You're reading the other way. I mean, it makes me a little concerned that it's becoming a bit too kind of insular and like harder to for the native English speaker who doesn't speak Japanese to get into manga.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's already some, like, you know, sometimes most of the way I use Facebook is groups, you know, so it's like I'm in a group of all these older fan gentlemen, fan GGs. Mm-hmm. And so every once in a while I run across them. It's like, I don't read manga. It's not for me, which is bizarre to me because it's manga is just comics. It's, mm-hmm. you know, like, I know that when they use it like that, they're referring to a very specific layer or design of Japanese comics. You know, they're not actually referring to all comics that any Japanese person has ever made. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Dragon Ball. Yeah.
Because immediately after, there's like the big eyes and the blah, blah. It's like, oh, God, that's the same argument they used like 30, 40 years ago, you know? Like, what's with the big eyes and the small mouth? And it's style. It's style, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you could say, mouse, what's with the anthropomorphic animals? That's crazy. It's style. It's a stylistic choice, and it doesn't necessarily impact the story. Like, if you're not a good visual storyteller, that will 100% impact the story. But like, character design doesn't, it impacts the appeal, you know, like whether or not you like the characters, how they look and something. But for example, when I was a big fan of the animation based on Leiji Matsumoto's works, right? Mm-hmm. But they are adaptations, you know? Different artists, different character designers redesigned those characters for animation so that they'd be easier to animate. And, you know, some of the stylistic parts are toned down, right? So when I first read the comic, it was a shock. It was like, you know, the rough lines and the heavy, you know, like really heavy lines was kind of not what I was used to. So at first I was like, I don't know. And especially like the stubby fingers, like all the stubby fingers. But then I realized that, you know, it didn't. And with Kirby too, Jack Kirby, it's like at first I thought it's so old fashioned. And then when I got into Commandy, I got in through the world, and then like the style grew on me. So it's, you know, I forgot what I was talking about. I went too far. I went a bridge too far, Tim.
So, of course, we saw that Heinkel was blasted by Kimblee last time. And so he's sitting there outside of the opening in the dome, bleeding. And Al comes out and sees him and is trying to help him. And, you know, it's not stated here, but we remember that some chapters ago, Ed and Al decided nobody else was going to die as they went forward with their kind of quest. So I'm sure that's what Al is thinking here. He's like, you know, I'm not going to let anybody die. So, and Heinkel's like, you just leave me. You just take care of yourself. Don't worry about me. And Al just refuses to accept that.
Yeah, yeah. We know. I don't think anybody who's following this story is going to forget that, because it was, they've been doing their best to keep that promise since they made it,
yeah,
you know?
Since Hughes died and they didn't want that to happen again.
I mean, Armstrong, General Armstrong. She didn't make that promise.
No. As the in memoriam box it attests in this volume.
Oh boy. I just, when I flipped to it, I went, oh no.
We'll get to that a little later. So, and we see Pride's Mr. Fantastic Arms with Baby Hands wrapping around Al's legs. So Al claps and kicks up a big, like, kind of dust cloud. Mm. And, but with the, his feet are still sticking out of the cloud. And Pride pulls on the feet and finds that he, Al has disconnected the feet from the rest of his armor body. And he's moving around kind of on his knees, tonk, 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 clank, 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 trying to move Heinkel. But it's not working very well, and he falls over. But then Heinkel remembers, oh, I've got a Philosopher's Stone. Can you, I looked it up, can you guess the number of the chapter where they found the Philosopher's Stone in the mine?
My God, so we're at 91 now. I'm going to make a really wild guess. 78.
Oh, you're so close. 77. Good job. Yeah, so they found that stone, and they think this is, and then they change scene, and then we never saw that stone again until now.
You know what? She did it, because I did forget about that. I've totally forgot about that stone. Usually I'm like, you know, I know that's going to show up. When's that going to show up? And I'll be waiting for it. But she did it. She kept it just enough, just long enough that couldn't remember. So I was like, oh, yeah.
So Kimberly and Pride are still standing outside of the dust cloud, and then suddenly there's a bizash from it, kind of a wind, and Al appears with feet. So he is alchemically generated new feet with the stone. And he comes out of the cloud dramatically with his eyes shining.
Dun, dun, dun.
And Kimberly says, impressive, most impressive, Alphonse Elric.
And then end of chapter. No.
Well, yeah, now we finally get the splash page with Father sitting atop a mound of skulls.
Those creepy, no-eyed cyclops skulls.
Ah, right. They've got a hole in the forehead, each one.
Yeah. I'm not going there, Tim.
So now, unexpectedly, we find May with the Envy in a jar running from a bunch of the artificial soldiers underground somewhere. I guess, you know, in Father's catacombs, I guess, under headquarters. The Envy's jar gets thrown up in the air as May is kind of fighting the artificial soldiers. And the cork in the jar pops out. And Envy is free. He says, I'm free. And he gloms on to one of the dolls and takes it over and then makes that doll bite another doll. And pretty soon he's joining together all of these artificial bodies into his true form that we saw in, what was it called? The Realm of Blood? That's what I call it. But when Lean and Ed were there. And then from that, his human form emerges. And he says, I'm back.
Just when we thought. I knew it was a bad idea.
How did you say I'm back in Japanese?
Ikikaita. I returned to life. Something like that.
And he says, thanks for bringing me all the way here, little girl. Couldn't have done it without you. And she has kind of a weird look on her face. It's kind of a smile and kind of determined. I'm not quite sure what she's feeling there.
Well, I think all you have to do is look at our little panda friend,
Xiaomei.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's what the, it's the determined, I think, trumps the hint of a smile.
But I kind of skipped over it before, but at the beginning of the scene, she was saying, "You tricked me, Envy," and he says, "I swear I didn't lie. The way to immortality is just a little further." So, yeah, maybe he's still trustworthy on this issue. It's unclear. His main priority here was getting his normal form back.
Mm.
But we'll have to see what happens after this. So then we're back inside headquarters, and Olivier Armstrong still has a sword at the throat of that guy whose arm she wrecked in the previous chapter.
That was ouchy.
Yeah. It says, "Order them to withdraw all Central City troops that are fighting Mustang and the Briggs soldiers." And there are soldiers with holding them at gunpoint. And she's still, like, slicing into this guy at various points in his body. Finally, he says, "Close the northern, southern, eastern, and western gates of the Central City headquarters. Close all the gates. Don't let a single one of the Briggs troops nor Mustang's men inside." She says, "You're rotten, but it seems you're not totally spineless after all." And then he's threatening her and the other Briggs people, and then Sloth comes up behind them, tries to smash Armstrong, but he misses and hits the other guy, and he's done for. But he was in pretty bad shape already, but yeah, now he is deceased.
He got Otomo'd, you know. He got Otomo, you know, Katsuhiro, the effect that, you know, the guy who created Akira, he's the effect a lot of the almost round indentation into a wall with all the cracks. It's kind of, you have to read Doma to know what I'm talking about, I think.
I read it quite a while back. It's hard to get a hold of. I think I was reading
it. There's like a perfectly round psychic force that, you know.
I think I read a scanlation of it or something. It's hard to get on paper, I think.
Mm-hmm.
In English, anyway.
Yeah, there were some floppies, right? I think it was released in floppies
maybe.
As
it
a
was
series.
Quite early in terms of manga in English.
Yeah.
We talked about it on Deconstructing Comics years ago. I can't even remember who I talked about it with. So now that he's dead, she says, "Ha, another position above me has opened up." Yeah, that's the way you rise through the ranks. Just everybody gets killed above you.
This is the first time to notice that her sword has little roses on them.
Yeah. And she says, "Thanks to you, I didn't have to soil this Armstrong family sword, which has been passed down for generations with the blood of scum." Then we have a scene change again, and Ed is beating up dolls, and Scar is also, and the Chimera is with them. But, of course, these things can't die, so they're not getting as far as they, you know, they just keep fighting. You know, they take a licking and keep on ticking.
Timex.
Timex, right. Yeah, that goes way back. Our younger listeners, if we have them, don't know what I'm talking about. It's an old TV commercial.
Still around?
I think so.
You know,
yeah.
Casio, do they still make watches?
I believe so. My own watch is Casio. I bought this 5 years ago or more. I can't remember.
Wow.
Now.
Isn't that weird? It's like all these Japanese companies, they're like, "Well, you know, we make keyboards, but what the hey, watches." And, you know, I don't know, I'm trying to think of another one, but there's all kinds of stuff like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Here's a culture shock thing that was interesting. After I moved to Japan, all the big, like ice skating rinks, there used to be one in Takadanobaba, and all these sports areas that had these huge clocks, all the clocks were Seiko.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's kind of one of the things that reminded me, like, yes, I'm in a different country. Different brands get, you know, get the contracts, get the big bucks.
Well, who would you expect it to be in the States?
Timex.
Timex, okay.
Texas Instruments.
I don't know that they're around anymore.
Yeah, I don't either. But they used to make some killer calculators.
Yeah, yeah. And Ed figures out that these dolls are powered by people's souls attached to them. One of the dolls bites, let's see, Gerso, the toad guy. But he says, my thick neck saved me.
What happens? Like, what do we know what happens if they bite?
I don't know. It's not like they're vampires. I think it's just what you would kind of expect to happen if someone with a huge mouth bit you in the neck. It's like you would bleed to death, probably. But
I asked that because the, you know, like the envy thing is, you know, it's using envy's power to, when he bites, he's, you know, kind of coming, they're all munching together into one big thing. But like, I know that's not at work here, but it just like, that visual is still pretty strong about the one biting the other and then becoming one. So I was just wondering if their bite had any special properties, but probably not.
I don't think so.
Hi, I'm Sophie, and I haven't seen a lot of movies.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm here to help with that.
And we are SP Film Viewers.
Each week, we take a deep dive into films that Sophie is seeing for the first time. Some of which are deemed classics, some of which are my favourites, and some are just to try and get a reaction from her.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we have a lot of fun talking about what we've watched.
And we hope you have fun listening to our light-hearted thoughts and ramblings on this cinematic journey.
So tune in every Thursday on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts from.
Now, I was thinking here, so it's been a long time since Scar killed anybody, and I'm kind of starting to feel like the character of Scar is kind of losing something. I mean, not that I want him to be a murderer, but I mean, he seems to have sort of changed his goals. I mean, he hasn't even tried to kill Ed, who's, you know, he's a state alchemist. That's who he was killing.
But hasn't he? Hasn't he changed his goals? Hasn't
yeah, I mean, changed? It's been a while since we've really looked inside Scar's head, and so I've kind of forgotten what happened a while back. But maybe he is, I mean, it's most important for him, I guess, to get the military rulers who wanted to attack his country in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think he realizes that it's not all black and white regarding the alchemists, right?
Yeah.
And that there are much worse, like the people pulling the strings are obviously much worse. And also folks like Kimberly who are gleefully, you know, doing genocide.
So when Ed and the Chimeras and Scar are facing off against all these dolls and they've blocked off the exit, and who is this? Zampano says, don't worry about it. If you hadn't done it, we would have destroyed the exit ourselves. And Scar says, exactly, we can't risk letting these get outside. And Ed says, for some reason, it makes me mad when you're agreeing with us. So he's still feeling pretty much the same about Scar. He's not comfortable being on the same side with him, it seems like. And I'm sure some of that is that Scar killed Winry's parents, and Ed can't forgive him for that.
Not easily. I think it's, you know, it's okay to have a complex relationship with, you know, a character like we're friends for now, but it doesn't, you know, it's not just that. It's also like, okay, yes, you made some terrible mistakes, but actually not all bad, you know, like, I think we need more of this in the world, is these, a more complex way at looking at folks, you know, unless you're in position of power and continuously abusing it.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people really oversimplifying other people's motivations.
Yeah.
So we end the scene where they're trying to get through the door where Father is, and they got a bunch of dolls standing in their way. So they're going to try to fight through them. And then we go into Father's lair with all the pipes everywhere and the goon, goon, goon. And Hohenheim comes in, and Father says, "You came alone? I was sure you'd bring the brothers, too." But Hohenheim says, "I don't need that many people just to scold one little troublemaking brat like you, right, dwarf in the flask?" And Father unattaches himself from the tubes in his back and says, "Slave 23, you once gave me a part of yourself. This time you will become a part of me." And that's the end of this volume, volume 22. Except for the back matter.
In this last two panels, you know, with their very angular beards, I want to somehow, like, see a beard battle.
A beard off.
Yeah. Who wore it better? They wore it exactly the same. Almost. Except one has a ponytail.
So we have more extras this time than we've had the past few volumes.
It's true. I like the little extras, illustration with Envy here.
Yeah, Envy coming out of his jar.
Yes.
So first we have a three-panel comic that's labeled From Chapter 91. So we just saw the actual scene that she's parodying here, where Al is trying to help Heinkel. And Heinkel saying, "Why do you insist on helping me when your own body is falling apart?" And Al says, "Because you're a cat." Since he can turn into a lion. So it's continuing the Al and cats running gag of the extras.
Good. It's been a while. I missed it.
So then we have seven whole four-panel comics. Way more than we've had recently.
Looking at this first one, I really thought about something. In America, when we think about cockroaches and we think about our dislike or discomfort with cockroaches, mostly it's the fact that there are a bunch of them, you know? One time, my only time to Miami, we spent the night in this like rental house or something like that. And in the middle of the night, I went out to get some water. And as I walked into the kitchen towards the light switch, my footsteps were going crunch, crunch. And I turned on the light. Okay. And the whole floor was black with cockroaches. And then in about 1 second, they all disappeared. They all fled. Pew! Under the fridge, under the cupboards, under
except
everywhere.
Except the ones you just stepped on.
Except for the ones that I had, I just Godzilla'd into the, you know. But so like when we think our hatred of cockroaches, it's that, you know, the group of cockroaches is what's especially disgusting. But like after moving to Japan, it's always the lone cockroach that like really gets under your skin. It's a... I remember in my old apartment in Suginamiku, and I walked into my bedroom and there was a cockroach on the ceiling staring at me. And I could do, do, do. It was just like this standoff, me and this cockroach. And I don't like bugs. So I stared at it and I was like, "Don't you move, don't you?" And then it starts running at me, and I screamed like a little girl, a four-year-old girl who had just been like kicked in the butt or something. I was just like, "Ah!" You know, and I ran out of that room.
The other thing with cockroaches here is that they're bigger than what you'd find in America. Right?
Well, I don't know
about Georgia.
Miami ones can get pretty big, and New York ones can get pretty big. Georgia ones, yeah, not so much.
Okay. But yeah, I don't know. I don't even remember seeing many cockroaches in Iowa. But
But oh my,
I'm sure they're there.
Yeah, they're big here. They're big, and they and American cockroaches too lazy to fly, but Japanese cockroaches will fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once in a while, it's kind of a last resort, I think, but they'll do it. So in this comic, so the English title is Roach Motel.
Oh, okay. It's G-sama.
Right.
In other words, G for Goki Booty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Cockroach-sama. It's giving sama, it a, like it's a really king. High honorific.
Yeah, because this is Kimberly, and we see in the third panel that he's staying in the Full Metal Motel.
Yeah.
What did they call it in Japanese?
Hagare something.
Okay.
It's so small, I can't read it.
I have to switch to my other glasses here. Because, yeah, this, a lot of it is so small. But, yeah, so Kimberly is fighting a cockroach with alchemy, and it blows the side out of his hotel room. We see it's the corner of the second floor of this motel. And in the last panel, among the wreckage, the owner is lecturing him. How many times do I have to tell you, Mr. Kimberly, no using alchemy on roaches? He says,
you know,
sorry,
what? I know what this kanji is. This is, I think this is so, like the Tokiwa so. And so this is not a hotel at all. This is a,
like a dormitory?
Like an apartment rental. Yeah, kind of dormitory kind of thing.
Okay.
Because she's the landlord.
That makes more sense. I think maybe the translator was wedded to the idea of using Roach Motel as the title. And so made this into a motel rather than some kind of a boarding house or dormitory,
right?
Apartment. But yeah, I mean, you don't expect the landlady in an apron like that at a motel.
Yeah,
because she looks like the maid. The motel maid is lecturing him, which doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
Okay. Second one called Fortunes.
Of course, I love how the cockroach is fine in the last panel.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Did I ever talk to you about the Bloom County, one of my favorite Bloom County strips with cockroaches?
Mm.
Bloom County is a strip, was super popular in the 80s. It's the first comic strip that I like would cut out of the newspaper and paste into a notebook, you know, and kept a collection of. And there was this one strip where the penguin character Opus is picketing a, like, we don't know what they're picketing, but it's like no nukes. In other words, stop using nuclear power and stop building nuclear plants, right? No nukes, no nukes. And this cockroach walks up to him and is like, I see you're protesting the nuclear power and stuff. And he's like, yeah, we want to get rid of it. And the cockroach is like, we don't care. You know, it doesn't affect us at all, you know? So we're indestructible, you know. He's like, so push the button, you suicidal goons. We're indestructible. And then Opus goes, squish, and steps off.
Yeah, so Fortunes. It's Ed, Al, and Scar approaching a fortune teller on the street like you might see in Tokyo.
And it says on the sign that, you know, like palmistry and reading.
Palm reading, face reading, name reading. I guess... Name reading would be like based on your kanji telling your fortune.
Kanji, it's almost like a numerology kind of thing. So it's like the number of strokes. So I think they probably use two different things, like meanings and then also using number of strokes and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, but each of our trio here go for the one thing that they can't possibly get from this fortune teller. Ed holds out his hand, you know, his metal armor hand, and the guy says, I'll read your palm. I'm sorry, I can't read that. Al with his face, I'll read your face. I can't read that either. And then to Scar, he says, name. And Scar says, I don't need to tell you my name, jerk.
What? No.
What did you guys come here for?
Okay, it doesn't have quite the same impact in Japanese. It's like So, in Japanese, like when like, I have to give it a little background. Like, in old samurai movies and something, like, you don't just, like, start talking to people. You have to announce yourself, you know, like, nanore, you know, like, announce yourself. And, but he's using that kind of, I don't need to announce myself to you. Like, that's what he's... Then they're all like, why are you here? Why did you even come here?
Right. And Ed and Al are saying, that fortune teller is not very good. Well, give him something to work with. Yeah. Next, the dangers of overeating. Mm. And we start with pride eating gluttony. Gobble. And then he says, I've acquired gluttony's abilities. Third panel, he's suddenly way overweight. Now I have the advantage, he says. But then in the fourth panel, he's just sort of rolling around on the ground like he, like a turtle that
Willy Wonka style.
Back.
I would say the Willy Wonka blueberry.
Okay. And Ed says, think you've made a mistake? Next is Full Metal Science Kids. And it's younger Ed and Al. Their mother is still alive. Al is a human. This is before all of that. And she gives them some juice, but they're concerned that one of them got more than the other, and they're measuring with scientific instruments.
Well, she's trying to be juice. She's trying to be motherly. She's like, don't spill your juice, you know,
mm-hmm.
as you would with kids. You know, like.
And they've put the juice in two graduated cylinders from Hohenheim's room. See, Al, you got 1.3 milliliters more than me. And it just escalates from there. They're arguing, and their mother says, smart kids can be such a pain.
Oh, yeah. Do you ever have to deal with that? Like, you know, when your kids start to know more stuff?
I don't remember those kind of arguments much. Certainly not that exactingly. Me, I can imagine my son when he was little might have complained, like, you got more senbei than I did or something. Okay, so before we started recording, you were telling me that this fifth strip is called G-sama 2, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. It's the sequel to the earlier Cockroach comic.
Right.
But given what happens in the four panels, the English title makes no sense to me. The Roach's Revenge. The Roach doesn't get any revenge in this one. The Roach didn't need revenge because it survived the fight with Kimblee. But in this one, it's up against Winry and Den bites the cockroach, presumably killing it.
You can see the cockroach's soul leaving its body.
Really, where is this?
Look at the line coming out of Den's mouth. There's a circle. There's a halo with two little wings.
I think it's gone from the English one. Show me yours. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. In English, they replaced that with the word crunch.
What? Why?
Yeah. I guess that they thought that little figure was a little hard to recognize. So see, I'm showing it to you. It's just the word crunch.
Huh. Maybe the translator's like, I can't read that Japanese.
Perhaps.
Is that katakana? Is that saying kuroku?
Okay. Yeah, so the English version leaves you hanging on just what the cockroach's end situation is. But in the fourth panel, Den is approaching Ed and licking his face after eating a cockroach, or at least biting one. And Ed says, hi, did anything special happen while I was gone? And Winry says, no, not really.
Dogs lick much worse than that, you know.
But yeah, I don't see why this is called the Roach's Revenge.
No,
it's more the Roach's End.
Yeah. The roach is like, ha ha, my entrails are now on your face, I guess.
I guess. Yeah, he gets posthumous revenge, maybe. Then we have campaign promises.
The Japanese title is Nihon Seifu Gambare, like Nihon Seifu mo Gambare. So like Japanese government, you do your best as well.
So we have a bunch of the soldiers, the guys that we've seen, you know, Mustang's group, who I'm blanking on this first guy's name. Anyway, he says, I hear that Major General Armstrong is aiming to become president, too. Another says, really? Then I know the third guy is Fury. Do you think Colonel Mustang stands a chance against her? Then they're talking about, well, way back in Volume 3, Mustang promised to change the female military uniforms to miniskirts if he's elected. And so then we see Mustang's approval rating versus Armstrong's, and he's way ahead. There's a bar graph. But then Olivia Armstrong says, a miniskirt government? Will that increase work efficiency? Very well, then. I approve. And there's the word consent here. I guess it means she's signing it or something. But now, in the last panel, now suddenly Armstrong's approval rating is way ahead of Mustang's.
So actually, in Japanese, she says, I'll think about it. Kento shio. But the asari, it just means like she quickly, easily changed her mind. So in Japanese, the sound effect is more of an effect.
Okay. And seventh one, it's called Full Metal is Coming to the Wii, you know, the game system, WII. And so it's talking about this character that doesn't exist in the comic, Claudio, the Prince of Erugo, who's apparently in the game. I think there might have been a backup with a comic about him in one of the volumes.
They have an ad. In the Japanese one, they have an ad for it.
Okay, yeah, it's not in this one. In the English, Prince is, but,
yeah.
And so, you know, all the very featureless girls just kind of, like almost like the artificial soldiers, just white, very simply drawn girls. You can tell they're girls because they have bows on their heads in their lack of hair, and they're all gushing over how handsome this prince is. And then Mustang is watching, and he's upset because he's losing out to this prince. And the caption says, also, when playing as the colonel, you can spontaneously combust. Okay, that's a lie. And yeah, he's spontaneously combusting. Foom. And then the special thanks column, where we see Arakawa amidst an army of gluttonies. And then there's a two-page ad for the next volume, but then there are a few more things that I guess were like on the cover under the dust jacket in the Japanese version.
That's right. Well, so in the Japanese one, they have that ad for the next volume, and then they have ad for other Arakawa works. Hmm. And then they, after they have the Wii game ad, and then they have a ad for like art collections for Full Metal. And then they have another two-page ad for all the books that are out, like supplementary and fan type books, novels, etc. Like there's like six novels at least at this time at this publishing. Again, this is mine is a first edition from 2009. Even though it's got that sun damage on the top a little bit.
Mine is also a first printing from January 2010.
Wow, just 1 year later.
Yeah.
So at that point, things were already moving along, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it must have been well known in the States by that time. And so probably as soon as the Japanese edition came out, they got to work on translating. So we have a one-panel comic, I'm not sure where this is in yours, where Gorilla Guy Darius is looking on.
The back.
Okay, yeah, the back cover under the dust jacket. And there's a banana hanging from the ceiling on a rope, and a chair and a crate, and stuff. And Ed comes in saying, let's try.
You know what? My rental sticker is right over Ed's.
His dialogue, his word balloon. Okay. So who knows what he says in Japanese. But I guess the idea is that he wants him to, like, put a blindfold on or something and try to hit the banana with the stick. There's a stick there on the floor.
Is there a blindfold?
I don't see a blindfold anywhere, but...
I'm not sure what this is happening here. At first I thought, is this a trap? Yeah, like, that he's going to... supposed to be catching in the trait, like catching him in the crate with the, you know... But that doesn't make any sense. Maybe
Darius is annoyed. He's got the bulging veins on his face. So
yeah, puzzle to be solved or something. I couldn't quite get it.
But I assume that he's annoyed because Ed is treating him like a gorilla, or like stereotyping him as a gorilla.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this relates to, like, for example, at Tama Zoo, the chimpanzees, they can use these huge wooden coins and put them in the vending machine to get drinks. Like, they can do complex, like, combinations of actions to do something. I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, that one's a little hard to understand. So then we have two panels, and in the first one we see Al and Pride's... Mr. Fantastic arms are around in his area. Actually, Al standing on Pride, on the black form of, not the kid form, but
what I think is Pride's form. Inside the armor, and it's kind of leaking through.
Yeah, I guess if you look at Al's eyes, but the arms are coming out, and they've got a dustpan and a broom, and eating rice with chopsticks, and. Ed and Lean are looking on, thinking, how useful.
No. So he says, what useful leg hair?
Big.
Snake it, which is here, you know, like your shin hair, basically. Okay.
All right. Yeah, lost something in the translation, I guess. Yeah. And then the in memoriam box. And there are seven people
packed
here. And I had to do a little research to remind myself who all these people were, especially since it's so small, it's kind of hard to make them out. But I think I've got them all. So the guy closest to the top, over on the right side there, that's the guy that...
got smushed?
Yeah, that Sloth smooshed in this last chapter. Next to him is the guy that Armstrong shot through the head in the previous chapter. The guy next to him, I had to look around for a while to figure out who this was. I got it, but do you know who that is?
I recognize the sideburns and the Mo. Hey Mo! Hair.
Okay.
But I couldn't remember what he was from.
On page 83... one of the Briggs troops in white knifed that guy.
Ah.
The guy in the middle with the mustache was killed by the artificial soldiers.
Oh. Oh, yeah,
and
that's right.
Then the guy in the lab coat below him also.
Right.
And then the last two guys are Ishvalans who were killed by Kimblee on page 47, or they were already dead on page 47, actually. We didn't see their actual murders, but at the end of chapter 88, when Kimblee reappeared after being away for some time, there were a couple of Ishvalan guys there who were dead. So that's those guys. So, yeah. It's a little tough to figure out this time.
Now, in this volume, I don't think we talked about it. The Arakawa intro.
Hmm.
What is it saying in English?
In the cartoon?
Yeah.
I didn't get to draw hues and lust here, but I guess everything turned out all right. So we're referring to the in memoriam box on the spine of the Japanese edition. And in outside of that, she writes, "Recently, I realized that the characters I've been so casually drawing on the spine of the cover only consist of the ones that made it to the final arc of the story." Oh, so that's talking about on the dust jacket in the Japanese edition, or on the actual spine of the English paperback, where there's a... Okay, so that's, she's not talking about In Memoriam. Okay, she's talking about on the actual visible spine, where there are characters on each one. But she never did those two characters, Hughes or Lust.
Do you think, like, looking at the cover again, it has full, there's a book, Full Metal Alchemist, and then behind him, there's something, a magazine or something, that has the number 22 on it. I wonder if the next volume also has a hidden title in there.
Yeah, because this is volume 22 that we're just finishing up here. Yeah, I hadn't noticed that.
It's, you know, just imagine, you're drawing a weekly or monthly series, and then your books start coming out, and like, oh, now you have to draw all these extra things. You know, like, super busy, you know, and it's crazy enough as it is. No wonder, you know, comic artists in Japan don't often live till their 70s. So R.I.P. Toriyama Akira.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. Sound effect.
Okay. There's a bunch of different sound effects, like different types of sound effects. You know, sometimes we get a chapter that's all booms.
Bang, wham, yeah.
You know what? I'm going to go with envy, jumping into the crowd of Cyclops automaton things. They're not really automatons. It's spawn, like a jumping sound. And he's saying, ta!
So you're talking about...
Page 152. So it's a jumping sound. It's not really a biting sound like what they...
Yeah, meant. English had glomp there. Okay. So. For me, it was no contest this time. Sloth smashing that soldier, the sound was smoot.
Interesting. It was, yeah, I looked at that. It wasn't that interesting in Japanese. It was just dobang. wait, which one are you talking about, the top or bottom? Smoot. Oh, okay, what's the next one?
At the bottom of the page is just crack.
Oh, okay.
With a K.
It's a weird, and it's megong in Japanese, which is pretty unique.
It's so like that's the floor breaking?
Yeah, it's like a bending and an impact sound kind of smushed together.
Hmm.
So I don't know if I would have gone with a straight crack.
You can say, I didn't like that crack anyway. All right, so that's chapter 91 and volume 22.
Boy, five left?
Five.
So we're going to start. Oh, boy, we're getting close.
But
I mean, we're still months away.
I know. I mean, the podcast is going, we're going to get to the end. Like, I think it's going to be end of December or maybe into January a little bit. So, yeah, we've still got many months of podcast ahead of us. I mean, I was a little surprised to realize how far out the final day starts in here. I mean, it started, I think, in, what, volume 21 even? takes a long time to get through this climactic bit here.
Well, you know, it's still not as... it's not like it's stretching every moment out like Slam Dunk... takes like 15 volumes to do one basketball game. You know, I mean, it was still a fun read, you know, Slam Dunk. It was still very fun to read. I didn't get, bogged down. But when you think about it, it's like, are we still on the same basketball game? It's not like Hunter x Hunter, where a whole volume was part of the same chapter called Greed Island, and it still wasn't finished. And that's kind of when I went, you know what? I'm kind of done. And I never picked it up again.
I've always wanted to finish Slam Dunk. I think years ago I was getting it from the library at the U.S. base where I used to work, but I don't think they had the whole thing. And I just read some of it. Yeah, somehow or another, I need to read the whole thing here.
Man, I would have killed to have access to an extensive English library. The only one I know of is the Tokyo American Club, which I went there twice to do a workshop, like for kids, like let's make our own comic book or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I ran into Kimura Takuya's wife, the old 80s idol, Kudo Shizuka, right? And it's all like really high elite businessmen whose company pay the million yen membership.
I used to work there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you get access to that library?
Yeah.
Dog.
Yeah, I could look around there. I found some stuff for work-related stuff. I mean, I was busy, but I did go into that library a few times, yeah.
Oh, man, I would, like, especially, like, once I became a dad, like, finding English books for my daughter was the big challenge. Luckily, like, there was a teacher who had, over the years, purchased tons of books for her middle school, you know, her junior high kids, but they were kids' books, right? And she decided to go back to America to have a kid. And so she sold all her books for like 100 yen each. And I bought 100. I literally bought 100 of them. I bought a whole bunch of Dr. Seuss, which was invaluable in teaching my daughter and helping her become bilingual. So, dang, you situated yourself to the two libraries that I know of.
Yeah, well, the base library was really great for the podcast because I could, you know, borrow paper books, not mess around with digital, and read them for free and put them back and not have to worry about storage space.
Yeah, a dream.
We reviewed a lot of those comics from the base back then.
Nice.
Death Note and whatever else. Okay, so see you next time. And Patrick, what is the law of equivalent exchange?
You know, Tim, I'll tell you. It's you get what you pay for.
Oh, that's right. Okay. All right, see you in 2 weeks.
See ya.
Our theme is Winter Fiend by Cryosyncope. You can follow us on Twitter at LOEE Podcast or email us at LOEEpodcast@deconstructingcomics.com. Support our show on Patreon at patreon.com/deconcomics. See you in 2 weeks. The Law of Equivalent Exchange is a production of deconstructingcomics.com.